"You must be a friend of Mr. Deutscher's," she said in a voice that admitted me into her confidence and seemed to promise sensational disclosures about the private world of others. It resonated with indiscretion. "Not really."
"Oh?
I'm here on a job."
"What do you do?"
"Locksmithing."
"I wish I had a job like that," she said, looking at her house. "Wouldn't that cause a stir?"
Her enchanting voice, punctuated with murmuring breaths, increased her radiant beauty.
"What's your name?"
"Henrietta Fine."
"Mine's Lily Gillespie."
At that moment, the woman leading the horse and child came up to the house.
"This is our nurse, Mrs. Pierce, and my son, Tommy. He's 4.
I warmly greeted them both.
"Now go inside and play with Nanny," said Lily.
The child obediently left.
I loved the golden woman immediately.
I told her about Mr. C and my work and Pop's hope that one day I'd complete high school and go off to college, but not Princeton, which Pop regarded as a refuge for drunks and rah-rahs.
"Don't repeat this, but most college grads are dim bulbs.
I went to Smith. It's in Massachusetts. My husband's from Vanderbilt. He grew up in Chicago. Lexington's my hometown."
I gulped. "Would you recommend college?"
"So long as you don't let on that you're smart. The college boys prefer dumb blondes." In the distance, I heard a shot. A bird dropped from the sky, landing on her lawn. She walked over and gently touched it with her foot.
"Perhaps it's an omen," she said. "This is the second time both finches, both dead."
Not a good sign, I thought.
"I think they come here from Europe, like so many of our immigrants."
Taking up the thread of her comment, I remarked, "There are a great many people who want to return. They're unhappy here. That's what I read in the papers."
"Money," she said. "It takes money to live the good life in America. The right kind of money."
Figuring a buck was a buck, I asked what she meant. Lily smiled, touched my arm, and said, "Some money is floored, so it won't open the right doors." Seeing Mr. C emerge from the house, I gave Lily a business card and invited her to call.
"It's as much a museum," I said, "as a locksmith's shop."
"Is it really?
I'd love to see you again."
She promised to drop by, and we parted. A week later, she appeared at the customer gate of Mr. C's shop. I assumed she'd come to see the collection, and in fact she spent a good half hour admiring the historical locks before she said that she needed a key for an apartment she kept in the city. It was on West 105th Street, in a long row of apartment houses, each the same as the other.
"No kidding. That's not far from where my mom and I live."
"It's on the top floor, number 707. I've lost my key, so I have no way of getting in. If we could leave now, my husband's away in Cape May." I asked Mr. C for permission to take on the job and explained that Lily was the woman living next door to Herr Deutscher. I couldn't resist inserting the hair. Mr. C said that given the age of the building, the lock was probably a Schlage or a Yale, and suggested which key blanks might work. He asked whether she was on the up and up. Mr. C had often warned me to verify the customer's story, and for good reason. One night, a couple had called him to make a key for their penthouse apartment on the swanky east side. First thing, Mr. C went to rouse the super to tell him what he intended to do. By the time he returned with the info that the owners of the apartment were in France, the couple had taken a powder. "But Lily could be trusted," I insisted. "All of life is a horse race," he cautioned. "There are no sure bets."
"Unless the race is fixed," I mused. And the one thing I knew for certain was that Lily Gillespie's beauty and seductive voice put her lengths ahead of any other woman I knew. Her blue coupe was parked at the curb. Throwing my canvas bag of tools into the trunk, I slid into the seat next to this fabulous woman to raft down the river of Broadway. If only the kids in Newark could see me now. "Keys," remarked Lily, "have more meaning than meets the eye. We give keys to loved ones, to open houses and cars and vaults. But we also use keys to lock out those we dislike and to keep them from learning our secrets." In my short time in the shop, I had learned that the attitudes people express about keys and locks provide a peek at their prejudices. You quickly discover, for example, who finds the world hostile and who embraces it, who worries about theft and who is generous. But never had any of our customers talked philosophically about keys until now. Lily turned right on 158th and parked in front of the building. Out on the street, some children were playing kick the can. It was a neighborhood trying to come up in the world. You could see the aspirations in the lace window curtains and the potted geraniums arranged on sills and fire escapes. The foyer, lined with copper-colored mailboxes, wore a menagerie of names like bear, beaver, fox, cats, mink, and wolf. Glancing at box 707, I saw no Gillespie, just the initials GD. Two steps led into the hallway, covered in linoleum with an octagonal orange design. The elevator, a pea-green paneled Otis lift, moved like molasses. On the ride up, Lily seemed abandoned in thought. I studied her every movement, wishing I could look exactly like her. A moment later, she turned and gave me the "Do I have something to tell you?" smile, saying, "You ought to have your hair marcelled. It would look terribly cute." Right there, on the spot, I decided that first chance I would make an appointment at the neighborhood beauty parlor. The elevator stopped. We opened the gate and walked down the hall to apartment 707. The door was hinged from the inside, and the apartment lacked direct access to a fire escape. One look at the lock, and I knew it was a Penn Tumbler Yale. Reaching into my bag for the key blanks that Mr. C had recommended, I lightly began filing one. Then I gripped it with the vice pliers, jiggled it around in the lock, and patiently filed the markings. In under 10 minutes, I had cut the key and opened the door, just as someone from apartment 705 peered out suspiciously. But an imperious glance from Lily caused the snooper to quickly withdraw. The apartment, which fronted the street, looked nothing like what I expected. Instead of spiffy furniture, there was schlock, a three-cushion purple sofa, a white parlor chair, and a wobbly coffee table covered with moving picture magazines, several copies of the Aryan newsletter, a jar of Noxema cold cream, an ashtray overflowing with lipstick-stained cigarette butts, and a small vial of perfume labeled Passionate Love. The dining room, only large enough for a card table covered with a green padded cloth and four rickety chairs, had a small lacquered plaque on the wall. God bless this tryst. A flower vase on the table held some dead stalks. The bedroom was a holy mess of sheets and pillows in disarray, a clothes closet with as many dresses and hats on the floor as on the hangers and hooks, a badly worn navy blue rug strewn with hairpins and shoes, and a dressing table overflowing with lotions, salves, perfumes, and pins, as well as an open compact of mascara and a caked eyebrow brush. A trail of white talc led from the table to the bathroom, which my fastidious mom would have attacked with bon ami and boiling water. From the street came the sound of a can being kicked and some raucous kid yelling, "I caught you off base, you're out." Lily pocketed the key and silently made her way through the apartment. The place reminded me of a magazine article I once read, "The Archaeology of Love: How to Tell If Your Husband Is Cheating." It didn't take much digging to uncover the facts. Standing in front of the bedroom closet, Lily reached in and recovered a man's pale blue cardigan sweater with a swanky coat of arms stitched over the heart. I couldn't help noticing that the closet also held a man's suit, trousers, shirts, slippers, and two pairs of shoes. Holding the sweater at arm's length, Lily said, "The son of a bitch. I bought it for him in London." She shoved the sweater under her arm and made straight for the door. I would have followed her out, but something caught my attention. A petticoat hanging from a hook looked just like the ones Pop used to make, the same kind of stitching, the same color silk. I read the label, "Sam Fine, Petticoat Lane, Cape May, NJ." At the curb, Lily asked, "What's that you have?" "A petticoat." She smiled and handed me a double sawbuck, apologizing for the deception. Even so, I felt like a patsy and wondered if my future held a jail cell. I said nothing during the drive back, a reckless, whirligig ride as Lily skidded the car at the corner and raced north on Broadway, weaving between pushcarts and cabs, hardly stopping for lights. Approaching the shop, she hammered the brake, causing the car to spasm with hiccups before it came to a stop. While I retrieved my canvas bag from the trunk, she stepped out of the car and jauntily said, "Marcel would look best, trust me." With that statement, my annoyance and fear disappeared. "Will you tell me something?" I asked. "Of course." "The green windsock at the end of your dock, what does it mean?" Lily paused, as if the question was a stumper. "It signals which way the wind is blowing." She patted me on the cheek, slid in behind the wheel, and drove off, leaving me wondering if I'd ever see her again. But the very next day, she walked into the shop laughing insincerely and whispering to a blonde, curly-headed, deeply tanned friend, whom she introduced as Miss Morgan Tabor. "Wasn't the Langland match simply divine?" Lily enthused. "She's the only woman in tennis who leaps for her volleys," Miss Tabor added, with an upward tilt of her chin. "Speaking of off the ground," said Lily, "did I tell you about that luncheon at the Holsteins? Beastly. You'd think we'd never traveled in Europe or gone to college. Instead of serving the food at the head of the table, they expected us to dish it out by ourselves. But worst of all, they passed the serving bowls to the right." "To the right?" Morgan gasped, as if she'd just been let in on a murder. "That's what comes of admitting the wrong kind of people into society." I was so angry, I wanted to spit. The woman I had so admired, the one who had told me that women with brains have to struggle, was sounding just like another nitwit. Was this the same Lily who talked thoughtfully about keys as we drove to that loveless apartment where her husband rendezvoused with some floozy? Already high class, Lily had no need to put on airs. Only later did I decide that she was not one woman, but two. The first, spoiled by beauty and wealth, never had to prove her true worth. The second, because of her savvy, wanted to have some say in the world and not be dismissed as merely a looker. I felt sorry for Lily. My guess was that if she spent as much time thinking about things that actually mattered as she did improving her wardrobe and face, she'd rank right up there with Madame Curie. "I've come to ask you a favor," said Lily, as Morgan discreetly wandered over to the small room housing Mr. C's antique collection. Her voice was warming up, readying itself to let me in on some fabulous secret. "Could we just step outside?" Standing on the sidewalk, I could hear the ballet master in the studio upstairs. Stretch, stretch, stretch.
You're such a clever young woman. Do you know how to change a lock?
She laughed insipidly.
How silly of me. If you can pick one, surely you can change one, right?
Right, I said indifferently. I didn't want her to think that I was taken in by that ha-ha-ho-ho stuff of hers.
Well, said Lily, remember that apartment on 158th Street? I'd like you to change the lock.
Who owns it? I asked. Looking me straight in the eye and dropping all pretense of gaiety, she replied,
My husband. He keeps it for his girlfriend.
Feeling that Lily's candor deserved my collaboration, I said, Don't change the entire lock. He might get suspicious.
I'll just change the plug. That way it's the same lock, but when the key slides in, it won't turn.
You are a marvel, gushed Lily. Won't they both be deliciously inconvenienced?
I'll bet the next-door neighbor tells them we called.
All the better. If Brad wants to accuse me, he'll have to admit to having a mistress.
When does he return?
2 days from now.
I could lose my job if Mr. Courtney found out.
There are some things a well-bred woman never discusses.
Lily wrote down her home telephone number and asked me to call when the job was done.
I may have other work for you. You never can tell.
Morgan was standing just inside the door waiting for Lily.
I prefer new things to old, remarked Morgan.
Lily laughed without any feeling.
Those old locks remind me of dungeons, said Morgan. I always keep my doors open.
That's because you have nothing to hide, Lily said rather smugly.
Come, Morgan directed. I have numerous errands and a hairdressing appointment at 4.
Lily leaned over and kissed me on the cheek. Slipping a greenback into my hand, she said, Don't look till I'm gone.
A moment later, only her perfume remained.
Who was that? Asked one of the apprentices.
Some peach.
Great Gans, said another.
A friend, I answered, and finally opened my hand to reveal a C-note, enough for several months' rent and a few fancy duds.